My name is Mark Preislach. I'm the general counsel here at RIMS. And today I would like to review corporate governance obligations, things that I think are important for chapter leaders, specifically board members, directors, and officers to be aware of. This program really was developed in response to a conversation that took place at this year's House of Delegates meeting. Several delegates expressed their thought that RIMS chapter leaders could use some or could benefit from some training in this regard. So with that in mind, we pulled this program together, and I hope all of you will find it beneficial. So the agenda for today's call is fairly straightforward. I want to begin by reviewing sort of the legal duties of the board. Then I'll go into some detail discussing fiduciary obligations. After that, I will touch on different ways that chapters can mitigate and manage their liability exposure. I'll then touch briefly on discrimination and sexual harassment issues. I'll follow that up with a brief discussion about privilege, specifically attorney-client privilege. And then I'll have a few concluding remarks and open the floor up for questions. So what are the legal duties of the board? Well, I think board members are fiduciaries of the organization, and this is a very important point that we'll be touching on throughout this discussion. And what that means is they have assumed a duty to act in good faith and with care, candor, and loyalty in fulfilling their obligations. So I think it's very important to understand that when you are elected as a member of your chapter board, you have essentially become a steward of the chapter. You are a fiduciary, and you've assumed specific responsibilities that you will be expected to discharge while you are a member of the board. The board is a collective entity. It is responsible and liable for what happens in and to the organization, and as the ultimate authority, it must ensure that the organization is operating in compliance with the law and its own policies. So what are these fiduciary obligations? I like to refer to them as the three D's. There's the duty of care, the duty of loyalty, and the duty of obedience. And these really are the legal standards against which all actions taken by directors are held. Put another way, this is really the playing field for any litigation in this area. Now, the overwhelming number of cases that are brought by plaintiffs against individuals who are acting as board members are essentially cases stating that the board member did not discharge their fiduciary obligations. I think the flip side of this coin is that board members can really demonstrate that they're discharging their duties by showing that they have fulfilled their fiduciary obligations. So what is the duty of care? The duty of care requires that directors be reasonably informed about the organization's activities, participate in decisions, and do so in good faith and with the care of an ordinarily prudent person in similar circumstances. I think the two most important words here are informed and participate. And I think if you look at the laundry list of ways in which you can carry out this specific duty, you'll see that they fall into one of these two categories, either being informed or participating. I think it's critically important that as a board member you attend board meetings. I would also argue that it's very important to prepare in advance for board meetings. I believe an agenda should be prepared, supporting documents should be pulled together, and all of that should be disseminated in advance of the meeting so the board members have an opportunity to review, digest, really understand what's going to be discussed at the meeting, and then hopefully they'll be well-informed and able to make a decision at the meeting. The next point there, obtaining information before voting to make good decisions, it is critical. And I can say that I've seen on occasion with the RIMS board will table consideration of an issue if they do not believe that they have enough information to make a well-informed decision. So what will happen is the decision will be tabled. They will ask staff to provide additional information. Once they have that information and they feel they are better informed and able to make a decision, then the issue will be brought up typically at a later meeting. So that's the duty of care. The duty of loyalty, I think, is fairly straightforward. It requires board members to exercise their power in the interest of the organization and not in their own interest or the interest of another entity, particularly one in which they have a formal relationship. Now, an obvious way in which board members would address this would be in disclosing any conflict of interest. So if you find that during a board meeting or at an upcoming board meeting, the board is going to consider an issue, and it's an issue that would require you to wear two hats, one more personal interests and the other as in the interest of the chapter, you'd be obligated to disclose that. And depending on the issue, it might be appropriate for you to recuse yourself from the discussion and would more than likely be appropriate for you to recuse yourself from the vote. Another issue that falls under this duty of loyalty is called the corporate opportunities doctrine. And it's rarely applicable in a not-for-profit setting, but I think it's worth understanding nevertheless. And essentially what it says is that if you as a board member become aware of a corporate opportunity that you reasonably believe would be of interest to your chapter, then you can't sort of squirrel that away and decide that you're going to pursue it on your own. You really have an obligation to bring that to the attention of your fellow board members. Now, if the board decides as a group that this really isn't something, that this opportunity is not something that the chapter wants to pursue, then subsequent to that, you'd likely be okay to go ahead and pursue this on your own. But the idea, again, is if you become aware of an opportunity that you think would be of interest to the chapter, then you really do have an obligation to bring it to the chapter board for their consideration. The last duty that I want to talk about is the duty of obedience. And again, I think this is fairly self-explanatory. It requires directors to comply with applicable federal, state, and local laws, adhere to the organization's bylaws, and really remain guardians of the mission. Again, you're fiduciaries. You're in a position where you are the ones who need to make sure that the organization is on track. And I think one very important way that you carry out this duty of obedience is by complying with regulatory and reporting requirements. Most chapters, not all, but most chapters will have two key filing requirements every year. One is an annual report that you would file with your Secretary of State in the state in which you're incorporated. That's a fairly straightforward process. Essentially, you're updating the state on any new board members, any new directors, any new officers, if there have been any changes to the organization's mission, that sort of thing. Typically, there's a nominal filing fee. And again, it's a fairly straightforward process getting that filed. Your second obligation is to file the Form 990 information return with the IRS. Now, I just learned earlier today that the IRS, this year the IRS revoked 275,000 tax exemptions for organizations because they'd failed to file the Form 990 in 2007, 2008, and 2009. So filing that information return is an absolute requirement. It needs to be done every year. And again, I would say that it's your obligation as board members to make sure that gets filed. Some states have biannual filing requirements for the state report. So there are some states where you won't be obligated to file a report every year. It would be every 2 years. Most states, however, require that you file those every year. So what are ways in which you can manage your legal liability? I would think that this first bullet point would actually be something that might put a smile on your face, because if you look at the most common reasons why nonprofits get sued, number one with a bullet is employment claims. And assuming that the overwhelming majority of chapters don't employ individuals, but are instead groups of volunteers who are working together to advance the chapter's goals and mission, you're very unlikely to face any employment claims. Again, that is number one by far. Other reasons why nonprofits get sued are contract claims, discrimination claims. I think one interesting area is discrimination in the form of programs. I would say think certification programs. If for whatever reason you had an accreditation or certification program, if that program would need to be absolutely objective in terms of its awarding those certifications. If there's any sort of disparate impact, if it appears that some, say, favored group is much more inclined to get that certification than a non-favored group, then there could be an argument that the program is not completely objective. Then you see torts of negligence, release of records, the availability of corporate records. I think that's another important point. Members of the chapter are entitled to review the corporate records. And the corporate records would be your articles of incorporation, your bylaws, and board meeting minutes. So within reason, again, chapter members are entitled to review those, and if they make a request to review those, then the request needs to be honored. And then defamation is the last issue. Again, probably not something that you would run into. You most likely see libel claims for things that are printed. What are some proactive strategies for mitigating or managing your legal liability? The first is proactive governance. I think it's important to say that you can't delegate your fiduciary responsibilities. When you are elected as a chapter officer or chapter director, you have assumed those fiduciary responsibilities, and you can't delegate those responsibilities to a third party. Another important point is you should rely on expert advice when that acumen or expertise is missing. So if the board finds that it's wrestling with an issue, and the principal reason it's wrestling with an issue is because the board members don't have the expertise to really drive a well-informed decision, then you have an obligation to seek out that expert advice before proceeding. Other ways that you can protect yourselves are incorporation. As most of you probably know, the RIMS Constitution and bylaws obligates chapters to separately incorporate within their respective states. Another is indemnification. Article 15 of RIMS Constitution and bylaws requires RIMS to indemnify chapter directors and officers if they satisfy three conditions. And those are: the person is acting on the chapter's behalf, the person reasonably believes that they're acting in the chapter's best interest, and the person did not know that they were acting unlawfully. So if those three conditions are met, then again, RIMS is obligated by its own constitution and bylaws to indemnify a chapter officer or director. On a related point is immunity. Several states, not all, have what are commonly referred to as volunteer protection acts, and they essentially provide the same sort of statutory protection for volunteers that, you know, Article 15 of RIMS bylaws would provide. And then the last issue is an issue that all of you are more familiar with than I am, and that's insurance. Specifically a D&O policy. So those are various ways that, again, chapters can manage or mitigate their liability exposure. So the next slide, slide 9, I want to touch briefly on the issues of discrimination or harassment. Both of these issues are much more likely to crop up in an employment setting. So again, I'm not sure that chapters that you would be wrestling with these issues, but I do think they're important, and so I wanted to just briefly touch on them. RIMS is an equal opportunity employer. We comply with all applicable federal and state laws prohibiting discrimination. And given that discrimination is unlawful, again, I would refer you back to one of your duties, and that's the duty of obedience. Board members are obligated to report and or pursue any instance of discrimination that they become aware of. With regards to sexual harassment, again, this typically takes place within an employment setting. There are typically two types, quid pro quo and hostile work environment. Hostile work environment claims are much more prevalent than quid pro quo. But again, these are the two types of sexual harassment claims that might arise. And it's my view the board members should be cognizant of their behavior, their language, jokes, is either delivered in person or via electronic means. They could be perceived as unlawful harassment. On the next slide, I wanted to touch briefly on attorney-client privilege. Again, I don't know the extent to which the chapters might be retaining outside counsel, the extent to which you use me as your attorney. I wanted to touch briefly on the elements of attorney-client privilege and then some concerns that I have. First, the person asserting the privilege has to be a client. The person with whom the client communicates must be an attorney, and that person must be acting in the capacity as an attorney at the time of the communication. The communication must be exclusively between the client and the attorney. It must be for the purposes of securing a legal opinion, legal services, some sort of legal assistance. And the privilege may be claimed or waived by the client only. Now, one of the issues that comes up quite often is, well, from a corporate perspective, who is the client? And the courts typically find that certainly any board member, a director or an officer, would qualify as a client under the understanding or interpretation of attorney-client privilege. Several courts have also broadened that to mean or to cover senior staff who are obligated to implement decisions that the board has made. What are the implications for attorney-client privilege? I think there are several, especially in this age of mass communication and specifically email. I think it's important to understand that email communications that don't satisfy all of these elements don't qualify for attorney-client protection. And I think it's also very important to understand that if there has been a communication that is privileged, you as the client can inadvertently waive that privilege by sharing the details of the communication with an individual or individuals who don't fall within the definition of the client. So, again, I'm not sure the extent to which this is going to impact you at the chapter level, but I do think it's sort of important to understand attorney-client privilege, when it will apply, and how it can inadvertently be waived. And once it's waived, it can't be reclaimed. Once it's waived, it's waived, and the substance of those communications would be discoverable down the road. On the last slide, there's actually one final issue that I wanted to touch on briefly, and that's antitrust law. I would say that at least once a quarter, I receive a phone call usually from some broker's general counsel, letting me know that he or she has learned through the grapevine that a discussion took place at a RIMS chapter meeting. And that discussion was very open, it was robust, but ultimately it was critical of the broker's business practices. So the attorney is very concerned and wants to make sure that I understand or that I was aware that this had taken place in case I had any antitrust concerns. So the call usually concludes with me thanking the attorney for the call and letting him or her know that I'll look into it. But at the end of the day, I think the starting point for any antitrust concerns is that the overwhelming majority of antitrust cases focus on seller conspiracies. It's agreements among a group of competitors to fix prices or to rig bids. Now, the principal concern, I think, from a chapter perspective, is if chapter meetings feature discussions that might cross the line into agreements, whether they're formal or informal, not to purchase products or services from a particular, in this example, broker. In other words, an agreement to boycott. That could raise some antitrust concerns. I think there are a couple of points to be made here. First, back in 2007, the Supreme Court, in a case called Bell Atlantic v. Twombly, and I won't bore you with all the details, essentially made it much more difficult for plaintiffs to establish that they have a valid antitrust claim that merits consideration by the courts. So at this point in time, it's much more difficult to, if you're a plaintiff, to get your case heard in court. And my view of it is, under the scenario that I've described, I believe that the broker would have a very difficult time satisfying the elements for an antitrust claim simply because a conversation took place at a chapter meeting. The second point I would make is, and I'm sure that the brokers are aware of this, I believe they would suffer a fairly significant reputational hit if they decided to pursue legal action against a relatively small nonprofit. Having said all of that, I guess there's one important point that I would leave you with on this issue, and that is, as chapter leaders, when these sorts of conversations start to take place, I would encourage you to pay close attention. And if for whatever reason they did start to veer into the direction of some sort of formal or even informal understanding that, hey, you know what, we probably shouldn't purchase products or services from this particular broker, well, then you are wading into potential antitrust issues. If there has been an agreement to boycott, again, I think the bar has been set very high. I think the risk here is exceptionally low, but in an abundance of caution, I would just advise you to make sure that these conversations don't go in that direction. If they do, I believe you have a duty to jump in and remind everyone that there are some antitrust concerns here and the conversation needs to come to a close. So those are just some of the issues that I think all of you as chapter leaders should be aware of. Again, I think really the primary focus is on your fiduciary obligations, your duty of care, your duty of loyalty, and your duty of obedience. And I think to the extent that you focus on these things and make sure that you are discharging those duties, then you are doing what you are obligated to do as a fiduciary for your chapters. And with that, I would be happy to take questions.
This is Barbara Munch. On the subject of antitrust concerns,
yes.
Do you see a particular problem if a group of risk managers exchanges information about policy limits and retentions just for the purposes of benchmarking within a particular industry segment?
You know, I don't. My gut reaction is that's okay to do. I mean, I think that you might be skating a little bit close to the line, but, you know, at the end of the day, there is no formal or informal agreement to take a concerted course of action against a particular broker or underwriter. So, again, I think the bar is still set very high for a plaintiff in that situation to make a case that, well, there's some antitrust concerns here.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I was also wondering, since nobody else is jumping in quite yet,
mm-hmm.
Is there a particular location in the RIMS website where we can pull up information about the current D&O insurance that's arranged through the central office?
This is Darlene, Chapter Services Administrator for RIMS. Did want to let you know that we do have our current insurance summaries up on the RIMS website under the Chapter Officer Tools and Resources page. You'll find it under Administrative Tools. And that'll be something that will be linked to the recording of this podcast in addition with the slides. But I did want to make folks know that it is currently available.
Excellent.
Hi, Mark. This is Kathy Mayer, the RIMS delegate from the Atlanta chapter.
Hey, Kathy. How are you?
Hey, great. First, I just wanted to say thank you because I was at the RIMS delegate meeting when we had this conversation, so thank you for making this happen.
Absolutely.
I actually have three questions. First is, can we share this with our chapter board?
Absolutely.
Right.
Yes.
And this is going to be up on the website, is it?
It is going to be archived, yes.
Okay, perfect.
Mm-hmm.
For bylaws, if
yes.
We actually are reviewing bylaws and making any kind of revision, is that something we're required to coordinate with National RIMS?
I would greatly appreciate it if you're going to be making any changes to your bylaws, if you could send them my way. Or I guess at this point you'd be more likely to send them to Cindy or someone in membership and chapter services. And if that happens, then they always get kicked to me for review. But I do like to look over any proposed changes.
Okay, and this, my last question is on our 990s.
Yeah.
Are we required to also send a copy of that to National Rooms?
You're not obligated by law to do it. No.
Okay.
Now I do know that. We would, I think, in the interest of sort of knowing, you know, where the various chapters stand with these things, we really would like to receive copies of things for the files. But I will say that, you know, at the end of the day, you're a separate legal entity from RIMS, so there's no legal requirement that you forward those to us.
And I'd like to jump in for a moment. This is Cindy Cherichilli, Chapter Services Manager. As Mark said, legally you're not required to submit it, but as they are submitted, we do collect them and save them. And so if you have a turnover in chapter officers or somebody loses their hard drive or changes jobs or many other different reasons, if we have it on file, then we will send it back to you when you need it. So
well,
we can test it.
I would think that it would be an important thing to have, especially since you're covering us for actions under the D&O policy, too. But perhaps if, you know, maybe that could be addressed in the FAQ and you could give us a way to upload those to National Rooms on the website, that would be great. So
okay.
Thank you, dude.
Any other questions?
This is Lucy Thompson from Orange County. I have a question regarding, I missed part of what you said at the beginning, and I apologize, I've got some laryngitis here. I missed what you said about notifying the state about any change in board members. Could you touch on that a little bit?
Sure. Actually, the chapter, as a separate legal entity, will typically have two filing requirements every year. One is your annual report to the Secretary of State in the state in which you're incorporated, and the other is your 990 informational filing with the IRS. And it's the annual report to, I was just explaining that it's the annual report you would file with the state, which is you would get the form from the state and complete it and return it. And essentially, all the state is really looking for is updated information on the organization. Have the directors changed? Have the officers changed? Has, for some reason, the mission of the organization changed? It's typically a very simple document to complete, and there's a nominal filing fee. And in most states, again, it's an annual filing requirement. Some states, for not-for-profits, have shifted to every 2 years filing requirement.
Okay. And I have one more question I wish to ask, and it's a delicate one. But if
okay.
a board member does breach the regular code of conduct at, like, a public event where they're representing the chapter, what do you suggest in the way of what is it the chapter would do if something like that should occur?
You know, my feeling about situations like that is they're best handled by the members of the board. I mean, my feeling would be that this is something that should be addressed at a board meeting and amongst the board members, so that what happened is, you know, brought to the individual board member's attention. It's explained to the individual board member that the behavior in question was inappropriate. And essentially, the individual's been put on notice that, hey, you're expected to perform at a slightly higher standard here, and that sort of behavior is not going to be condoned going forward.
Okay, that's what I thought. Thank you.
Yep. Any other questions?
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Mark. I think this is very informative.
Absolutely.
We did receive a couple questions offline that will be included in the FAQ, and that was from a chapter wanting to know what the legal obligations are if you're hosting a raffle or 50-50 at your chapter event.
Yep, I can lay that out for everyone.
Okay, great. And I think that that's a question that we get from time to time anyway, including what if you're serving alcohol at events such as holiday parties? So that will be included. Anyone who registered for this event will receive a copy of that FAQ via email, as well as when it's posted online, it'll go on the chapter officer's e-group for those that were not able to attend today. So we look forward to getting that out to you soon. Okay, well, as always, if you have any additional questions or if you'd like to take it offline, you can send it to us at chapterservices@rems.org. And if you have another question for Mark, if you don't want to contact him directly, you could send questions to him through us, and we'd be glad to help you with that. So thanks again, everybody. Mark, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to do it.
Have a great day.